This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
This episode is brought to you by the new ANTS Memory Profiler 5. It offers clear presentation of profiling results so you can find your memory leak within minutes, and you don't have to claw your eyes out after going through tons of log files. We've got a link in the show notes for a free 14-day trial, so give it a shot. All right, on with the show.
Welcome to this episode of Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on June 25th, 2009, and our guest today is Marcus Volter. He is a consultant and coach who specializes in model-driven software, DSLs, and all sorts of good things. When he speaks, you'll probably recognize him as the voice of Software Engineering Radio. So welcome, Marcus.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, we wanted to have you on the show to talk about some different things, particularly because you spend most of your time outside of the Microsoft world. Isn't that right?
That's right, yes. I have done some projects in the Microsoft space, but that's the exception.
Right. And you did want to talk about some things like model-driven software, and is model-driven and DSLs, is that the same as programming? But I also wanted to talk on what I think is your primary operating environment, which is Eclipse. And if you could maybe, based on what you know about Visual Studio, if you could kind of compare and contrast the two for a lot of our listeners who probably have never launched Eclipse.
Well, I guess I will be a little bit biased because, of course, I know Eclipse much better than I know Visual Studio, but let me try. So I guess both have, at first glance, they have the same goals. They're primarily a development environment, and they are an extensible development environment in the sense that it's possible to build your own language editors, plugins, whatever you call these things. So most people know Eclipse as a Java editor in the same sense as, or I should say, Java IDE, right? In the same sense as people know Visual Studio as a C# or Visual Basic editor. However, I would say that Eclipse has a life beyond that. And this beyond would be alive as what you'd call as a generic or general platform for tooling environments. So, for example, there is a big tendency in embedded systems or among the tool vendors for embedded systems to build all their development environments, debuggers, profilers, editors on top of Eclipse. And there is also what's called Eclipse RCP, which stands for Rich Client Platform, which is a way of using Eclipse without having it act as a development environment. There are examples where biologists build, I don't know, some biology data management application based on Eclipse. So all the IDE-ness is removed, and what remains is basically a nice windowing and UI framework that you can use to build all kinds of applications. So I think the Eclipse environment has much more of a focus on that extensibility than the Visual Studio world. And then, of course, there is the difference that it's open source and, you know, developed by a community and all that stuff.
Sure. What? How would you go about writing a plugin? Is there some sort of protocol that you have to adhere to, or are you restricted to a specific language?
Well, I would say that for all intents and purposes, you write your plugins in Java because Eclipse itself is implemented in Java. And, well, you can, of course, also write plugins in other languages that are, let's say, compatible to Java in the sense that they also run on the JVM and that they use the same conventions about encoding classes. For example, you can implement plugins in Scala or Groovy, right? Mm. So a plugin is written by basically doing two things. One is you have to write a couple of declarative metadata in the form of what's called a manifest file and an XML plugin descriptor. The manifest file is something that comes from Eclipse's OSGI history. Eclipse runs on top of OSGI, and every plugin is also an OSGI bundle. And OSGI bundles come with their own piece of metadata, which is called a, well, bundle manifest file. And then in the plugin descriptor, in the plugin.xml, you declare which kinds of UI features your plugin contributes to the Eclipse workbench. And based on that, you have to implement in Java code or in the other languages I mentioned, certain interfaces and implement, you know, some whatever subclassing existing framework classes to provide the functionality.
Okay.
I guess that's a general pattern for all kinds of component infrastructures that you describe certain things declaratively. Typically these days, unfortunately in XML instead of good language, and then you provide the behavior for your plugin in code. And of course, the idea is that the framework will only read the deployment, the descriptor to put your UI elements into the framework, and then only if you access one of these elements, the actual implementation code is dynamically loaded. It's a way of, you know, only loading that code that's actually needed.
So in the Visual Studio world, the way of adding plugins is usually requires some kind of, you write an installer and there's some COM stuff that kind of makes it a pain in the neck. Are these plugins a little easier to install in the Eclipse environment?
Well, in general, you can export plugins in various ways, typically as jar files, archives, and then you can also write what's called features. Features are collections of plugins that somehow fit together, and then you can package them in various ways. You can put them on what's called update sites, which is basically websites with a specific structure so that Eclipse can access those websites to, you know, download things and install them. Eclipse comes with its own deployment or a provisioning framework. These days it's called P2, the second try at providing an Eclipse-based provisioning framework. It worked quite well up to Eclipse 3.3. In 3.4 it didn't work. And in 3.5, which was actually released yesterday, rumors are that it works again. So what you can do is you can point your Eclipse installer to any, you know, update site URL, and you get a listing of the available features and plugins, and then you can install it from there.
Excellent. So a couple of things you wanted to talk about. One was model-driven development / DSLs. And I wonder if you can give us some background. I can tell you up front, coming from a Microsoft world, typically when someone mentions model-driven software, if you look at white papers on MSDN, you'll see things about the class designer and a distributed system design surface where you drag and drop shapes.
Yep.
But interested in hearing your experience about this.
Well, I mean, model-driven development is, you know, if you look at it from 10,000 feet, then what it is basically the idea of using models to implement software. And the way you typically do this is that you, well, describe something using a modeling language, and we'll talk about suitable modeling languages in a minute. And then once you have that, you can either generate code from that model, or you can feed the model into an interpreter, which directly executes the behavior specified by the model. So that's the general idea. Now, I think as a computer scientist or software engineer, I think the idea of describing things in a level that is more abstract and more problem domain specific than implementation code is kind of an obvious idea, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes people don't believe that it's possible in meaningful environments because they only know modeling languages such as UML, which are not necessarily, you know, very suitable for real systems. Or people think that it's not easily possible to write code generators and that it's so much effort that it's kind of prohibitive. So I guess what has changed over the last couple of years is that the tools for defining your own languages and corresponding generators have matured to the point where building these things is, it's not trivial, but it's something that a good software engineer can easily do with an acceptable level of effort. And in that sense, I would say that model-driven development is on its way to become mainstream. It isn't mainstream yet, but it's clearly on the way. Something that I found quite funny, I was just to refer back to the Microsoft world, I was at the code generation conference last week, actually a very good conference, by the way. Do some plugs here. and I'm not involved, so I was in the program committee, but I mean, it's really a good conference. Point is, I was on a panel with Steve Cook from Microsoft, and I learned from him that he is now on the OMG working as the Microsoft representative for UML. So, and I asked him, why is Microsoft, after having ignored UML for years, why are they now going towards UML, where kind of everybody else is, you know, not everybody where, but many people say that, you know, domain-specific languages are actually more useful than UML. And he said that the customers, Microsoft's customers, are requiring them to do that. So that's actually quite funny.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've peeked at some of the UML tools that come in Visual Studio 2010, which is in beta, but other than playing with a sequence diagram, I haven't done that much with it. What do you think's the characteristic difference? When am I using a DSL and when am I using a model?
Well, let's clarify some terminology, because the question, as you asked it, in my terminology makes no sense. Okay, so let's agree on the terminology. A DSL is a language, and you use a language to create, now, how do you call these? Programs, sentences, models, right? So a model is something you create with a modeling language. And this modeling language can be generic or unified, right? Or it can be a very specific or domain-specific one. So if you ask me whether you should use models or DSLs, then that question makes no sense, because you use DSLs to create models, which you then process. So I guess if you wanted to ask kind of, you know, whether you should use DSLs or UML, I don't know if that was the question, but if that was the case, then I would...
No.
Okay.
Well, and to some extent, there's a blurring between these two, particularly just on some of the things that I've worked on, where people will talk about, for instance, I don't know if you're familiar with Windows Workflow, but it's a technology from Microsoft where you can arrange activities on a design surface.
Yes.
And you know, it'll sometimes be referred to as building a model of a business process.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it'll also be referred to as, you know, if you look at the words that are inside of these shapes on the screen, there's sort of a domain-specific language there, such that a business person should be able to look at that and say, and at least understand it, maybe not be able to rearrange things and program it.
So I would call these words inside, well, it's really hard to give good names to these things, but these are more like an ontology or a glossary where you agree on certain words so that people know what it means. Now, if you talk about real DSLs, then those DSLs have a formal definition. They have a formal meta model behind it. They have maybe a grammar, so you can express instances of the DSL formally. So in that sense, what I would say is that the design surface that is used to describe, let's say in this case, workflows, that I would say that Microsoft has defined a, well, broadly applicable modeling language. So I'm not sure if you want to call it domain specific, but it doesn't really matter, right? They've built a custom modeling language that users of the Workflow Foundation can use to describe workflows. So that's how I would see it.
Okay.
I mean, this whole terminology thing, I mean, everybody has different names. Some people talk about domain models to refer to the abstract syntax. Others call these things meta models. Martin Fowler has also this thing of the semantic model, which is something slightly different. Then the question is, do you call things models or specifications or programs? In some sense, really, it doesn't matter. I mean, the whole idea is that if you want to express something in a domain, for example, insurance contracts, or pension plans, or radio telescope observation specification, or enterprise software distribution in a computing center, or state-based behavior in an embedded device, or remote communication through a CAN message bus, then what you want is a language that is specific to the kind of things you want to express. And then you take that language and express whatever you want to express very, very precisely, very concisely, and in a way that you can process it in code generators, right? I mean, that's the idea. Mm-hmm. And if you want to express generic, object-oriented programs, then we already have languages for that. Because everybody uses OO, there are kind of standardized languages, right? C#, Java, whatever. If you want to express some things that you want to, you know, that are more specific to your business domain, then chances are that there aren't any existing languages to describe that, because hopefully your business domain is somehow specific to your business. That's why you make money. So you will have to build your own languages that are closely aligned with your business domain. And that's the idea of DSLs. And that's also the explanation why something like UML will never work in that space, because UML is generic and it can never be closely aligned with your particular business domain.
I had never put that together. That's a very funny contradiction, you know, like the whole idea of UML being generic and completely in the face of any kind of domain-specific anything.
Yeah. I mean, you can extend UML, right? There are profiles, and profiles allow you to, let's say, overlay any domain-specific concepts on top of UML. So in that sense, you could argue that UML is a toolkit for building your own languages. And of course, that's true technically, but the tool support for building profiles is quite limited, and also in some sense tool specific. And also, I mean, if you want to build your own languages and want to use a, let's say, language toolkit for doing that, there are much better alternatives than UML.
Hmm. Do you see a difference, or what would you say is the difference, if there is one, between modeling and programming?
So we have to be a little bit, well, let's again clarify a little bit more specifically what we mean by modeling, because that's important. Sure. If I talk about modeling, then I always mean modeling in the sense that you model formally so that the models can be processed. Your models might be very abstract, right? They might describe mathematical notations for insurance mathematicians, but the description is precise and formal and tool processable. If you just refer to modeling, if two people stand in front of a flip chart and draw a UML diagram to try to understand some kind of system, then this is not formal, it's not complete, and therefore it cannot be processed into anything executable. So if we consider this, the first definition of modeling, where the models are formal and tool processable, then I would argue that it's the same as programming. So what I always get is, or sometimes get as feedback is, you know, Marcus, that's all nice and dandy, but if you go to a business expert and have them program, that will never work. And I think that's true, because if business people would be able to program, then they were programmers, would be programmers. But there is a difference between being precise and being able to program, because programming is about, you know, efficiency, about handling exceptions, about making things Turing complete and, you know, executable as a closed complete system, whereas a specification doesn't necessarily have to be executable. It only must be precise enough so we can generate something that's executable. And my experience is that in many domains, not in all domains, but in many domains, there are people who are capable of precisely, formally and precisely specifying facts or, you know, behavior in their specific domain. Examples are, again, insurance mathematicians. These are very precise people, right? They're mathematicians.
Mm-hmm. They have to apply a certain, almost an engineering type rigor,
yes,
to their work.
Exactly. Or other examples are logisticians, right, who plan supply lines or supply chains, or scientists, again, who specify an observation for a radio telescope. These are all very, very, well, as you say, structured engineering-like people. And if you give them a way to express their concerns with a given system, they can do that. It's just if you only give them Excel and Word, then they're not going to be able to do that, right? So what you want to do is you want to build tools, languages that allow them to express meaningful things about their domain, about their systems, and then you can take that as one of the inputs for generating a system. So you know, the what of the domain comes from the models, and the how, you put that into the code generator. And as a consequence, what plus how gives you an executable system.
Yes. Now, so speaking of tools, how would you go about that with Eclipse? How would you start?
So maybe I should have said that before. Eclipse is also a community and basically a website, a huge open source project with all kinds of things. There are, you know, tools for embedded development, tools for report creation, all kinds of things. And one sub-project of Eclipse is Eclipse Modeling. And modeling contains various things for defining languages, for defining code generators, model transformations, model validators, and all kinds of stuff. So what I would do is I would first decide whether I wanted to create a textual or a graphical language for domain. Now, I tend to be a big fan of textual languages because I think the whole graphical stuff is oversold. It gives you all kinds of problems regarding diff, merge, tool integration. And as soon as you have kind of algorithmic behavior or any, let's say, detailed stuff, graphical doesn't work anyway. So I like textual languages. So what I would do is I would grab the textual modeling framework in Eclipse. I would define a grammar for my language. Of course, I would do that interactively, you know, talking to the domain expert who really understands what the domain should be about. And then I'll build a little bit of a language. I will, you know, generate the editor, take the editor, write a little model, discuss with the domain expert whether that kind of model makes sense. I will collect more examples from the domain expert, try to express these examples with the language I just created. Of course, I will notice that I made a mistake or the language is incomplete. So I go back to the language grammar, change things, adapt things, extend things, regenerate the editor, create more examples. And I do that very iteratively, like, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes per iteration, and really like iterate my way into the brain of the domain expert. And that works really well because these, especially these textual language definition environments, are really very lightweight. And, you know, doing this in a couple of minutes or maybe, you know, tens of minutes iterations is not a problem at all. So I would do that for a while. Yeah, sorry.
That's pretty amazing just to think about it being, as a lightweight process.
Yeah. And see, this is this thing. If you talk about model-driven and modeling, most people think about UML and other bloated, heavyweight environments. And they those tools never really succeeded in actually fulfilling what they promised. And they give you all kinds of headaches regarding how do you do the nightly build and how do you version and diff and merge models and how do you put something on a branch in the model repository and in your source code. This really never really works. So if you adopt this textual approach, then many of those problems are gone. And the TMF framework at Eclipse is really a nice thing. And by the way, Microsoft is doing something similar with Oslo, right?
Mm-hmm.
This clearly goes in the same direction, and it looks very promising. Not finished yet, far from being finished, but they have nice things. So, and just to reemphasize, what this TMF, the textual modeling framework, also gives you is it's not just that you specify the grammar and you get a parser as you would expect. It also gives you an editor with code completion, syntax highlighting, an outline view, go to definition, find references, error markers in the editor, live error markers. So you get basically a full IDE kind of, right? So, and I think that's important. I mean, you don't convince anybody of using your language if you have to use it with Notepad exe, right? I mean, this is just a joke. So getting a good IDE is an important ingredient.
So this would be like a standalone editor?
No, it's an Eclipse integrated editor. But what you can do is you can package that editor as an Eclipse RCP application, and so effectively giving users a standalone editor. But that requires a little bit more work. You don't get that out of the box.
So if you've looked substantially at Oslo, I'd be interested in hearing your sort of compare and contrast about the approach that they've taken versus what the Eclipse guys are doing. And also, I mean, I know that they've been kind of pushing M, the modeling language, as you'd like to see alternative implementations as a standard language that other people could implement. Do you see that getting any traction?
I think it's really hard to compare the two now for two reasons. One is that Oslo really isn't finished. And depending on who at Microsoft you talk to, you get different statements about what it's going to be like once it is finished. For example, the official statement is that they won't do code generation. Okay, they only want their models to be interpreted. Now, of course, the demo they're doing currently always generates SQL, so that raises questions. And if you ask certain people, then they say, yeah, we'll add code generation later. But currently, there are also the Microsoft DSL tools, and these are different products and different units, and we don't want to have competition among us, so we don't do, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know. The other thing is that if you talk to yet other people and look at some other demos, then those folks emphasize the integration into the SQL server. It acts as a model repository in that context. They emphasize that integration so heavily that you get the impression that they're trying to sell M as a replacement for SQL for data modeling, which is, I think, complete and utter nonsense, because the database guys will never go away from your SQL. And the point of M is not, the importance about this thing is not that the models are stored in SQL in a database. Who cares? It's just a repository. The important thing is about the ability to build your own languages. And some of these demos seem to get that completely wrong. So I think there is a lot of potential. The parser they are building is, or the parser tooling they are building is quite nice, but Microsoft is big. I guess many people are involved in Oslo. Among them is, as I'm told, also the SQL server division. So I think there is a lot of possibility for Microsoft to screw this up by marketing it completely in the wrong way. So I really don't know.
Yeah, you know what actually scared me about Oslo? You were at the DSL DevCon in Redmond a couple months. That's where I introduced myself. But I don't know if you remember the panel discussion. Don Box is on that team, and he was also on the panel. And when they went through and introduced each person, and when they got to Don Box, he said, "Hi, I'm Don Box, and I'm here to bring you closer to your data," or something to that effect, which I don't want to be closer to the data. I want to be closer to the domain. So I'm also worried that they're going to screw things up by turning this into another extension of SQL Server somehow.
Yes, so that's my fear too. But on the other hand side, I mean, if you think about what is data, I mean, data in some models are data. Data is models, right? I mean, a database schema, you could argue, is a language. Well, you express these things very crudely because everything is tables, okay? But I mean, in some sense, there are a lot of what's typically called data-driven applications where mm-hmm. a database schema captures how the application should look like, and then there is a framework that renders some UI based on the data in the table. And I mean, except that the syntax is awkward because it's all tables, you could argue that this is a form of language. So in that sense, data and models are quite close. The question is how you express them and what is a good notation. So in that sense, I would agree that bringing people closer to the data is a good thing. Problem is, of course, as you just said, if they kind of sell it as a as a replacement for SQL, I think they're screwed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's been so many Microsoft tools like Access and parts of Visual Studio where you can go, you know, drag and drop a table out of some Server Explorer, and then you end up with a UI all of a sudden. Yeah. So,
I think that the thing about domain-specific languages is really not just the fact that you can build a language that can capture any data, but maybe more importantly, that this language actually has a notation or a syntax that is useful to the users. I mean, if you let's look at mathematics, right? I mean, the mathematical notation, you could argue, is a domain-specific language for expressing mathematical stuff. And if you go to a mathematician and say, you know, you guys with the strange notations, with these integration symbols and all these Greek letters, can't you get rid of that and use 7-bit ASCII and maybe represent everything as tables? I mean, you know, for me as a computer scientist, that would be much easier because I could process the data more easily. They would say, forget it, because in order to think efficiently about things, you need a concise language. And that conciseness comes quite a bit from the notation. So emphasizing notation over pure theoretical language content is an important thing. And that's also where the different DSL/modeling tools are different, right? I mean, to what extent can you customize the notation? In UML, everything is boxes and lines, basically. And then if you use a parser-based environment like TMF or Oslo or Antler or Lex, Yak, everything is basically 7-bit ASCII. You cannot imagine, you cannot put a nice rounded integration symbol and a sum symbol, you know, and a DX differentiation stuff. You can't easily put that into an ASCII file because you don't have the layout capabilities. So the question is where we go from here and which kind of tools we could have so we can have any notation that is much more closer to certain formalized domains and not just 7-bit ASCII or boxes and lines.
Mm. It does sound like you're more of a fan of, and this is another gray area, but it sounds like you're the fan of an external DSL where you define your own grammar instead of like taking the Java language and doing some pushing the compiler to its limit to come up with something that's kind of readable.
Yeah, I agree. You diagnosed this very, very, very correctly. I'm a very big fan of external DSLs. I mean, there are some programming languages that support kind of meaningful internal DSL stuff. I mean, you can do interesting things with Ruby Rails, right? The Ruby on Rails thing is a good example. But if you look at how the internal DSL is implemented, right, it is implemented as more or less obvious meta programs, usually less obvious. So you never have a nice grammar. It's all done with more or less obvious language tricks. There are other languages that have better support for that. For example, in Scala, you can do internal DSLs that are even statically type checked. For example, there's a language called Converge, which it's done by Lawrence Tratt at forget which university is in the UK, and he has also a way of doing internal DSLs, but he does it by embedding grammars into the language and then using. You know, he basically has an extensible parser framework that if a fragment of your own DSL shows up internal to the host program, the correct grammar is used to parse that. So that's, I think, a much cleaner implementation of the idea of internal DSLs compared to this metaprogramming madness that you sometimes see. And the other thing is, all these internal DSLs that I know of, at least those that are relatively mainstream, are done in dynamic languages, which means you have no typing, no static typing, and you have usually no IDE support, you know, code completion and stuff. Certainly not for your DSL, because the meaning of the language isn't available declaratively. It is specified, you know, through some meta program, which the IDE, your text editor, doesn't know about. So that means you never get any decent tool support for those internal DSLs. And that's, to me, a problem, especially if you target more business users. They want meaningful error messages in their editor. And these meaningful error messages should be on the level of the DSL and not, you know, some kind of result from some weird meta programming that gives you some internal error message. So yes, I think internal DSLs are not quite as powerful as external DSLs. Although they have their use, of course, no question, but more for as a tool for programmers, not so much as a tool for domain experts. Thing is, things are blurring, okay? There is a tool called MPS, Meta Programming System, from JetBrains. What they have is what's called projectional editor and intentional software. You've seen the demo at DSL DEF CON, right?
Right.
They are doing the same thing. So instead of parsing text and editing text that is then parsed, what you do is you see something that looks like text, but once you edit it, you directly edit the underlying data structure. And that allows you to, you know, very easily extend languages and define all kinds of notations. For example, with JetBrains MPS, what you can do is you can introduce new language concepts into existing languages, like Java. I mean, they have Java in their system, and it's a matter of 15 minutes, literally, to add a new keyword to Java, okay? And then the question is that an internal DSL, or is it an internal extension or external? I mean, it's certainly internal, because you extend an existing language, in this case Java, but it is completely statically typed. You get tool support and everything. So things are blurring here.
Yes. John, Kevin, any questions?
Well, I was just thinking about from looking at the presentation you gave at DSL DEF CON, and you were showing the Eclipse tools integration. I know you've talked about that some, but did you want to talk more in detail about exactly like what some of those features are? Like I noticed there are some pretty interesting visualizations.
Yeah, so, I mean, before, like 10 minutes ago or something, I talked about how I would go about defining my own language, and I basically stopped at the point where we kind of finished the language. But, of course, what we need to do is we need to write language processors, usually code generators. So what I would do next is I would think about how I would implement the system that my DSL describes, and I would typically write a prototype manually just to get a feeling of how I would implement something like that. And then I would write code generators based on, in this case, in the Eclipse case, the Expand template engine. And, a template is simply basically, well, a template language is a domain-specific language for generating code, right? So you can navigate over the model and basically specify the code that should be generated based on what you find in the model. And so that's what you do next, generating code. You typically also do that iteratively. And then you generate the system. You then typically write some unit tests to verify that the system actually works. If you're really into model-driven, you might even come up with a sub-language that allows you to model the tests, so you can even generate the tests. That's all quite nice. Now, if you do textual modeling, you sometimes do need a graphical representation to, you know, to give you an overview over things. So, but instead of going over into the to the dark side and do graphical, so instead of doing full-blown graphical modeling, what you can do as a very good compromise is to create a visualization. For example, there is a tool called GraphVis. It's a very old Unix-based tool. Command line that allows you to specify a graph using a textual language, and then it renders a nice, you know, picture from it. You can specify shapes and line thickness and color and arrows and stuff. And so what we have as part of this whole Eclipse stuff is an integration with GraphVis and also other visualization frameworks, but I'll stay with GraphVis for now. And what you do is you write a model transformation that maps your own language to this graph language, and then you can generate the graph with textual notation from it and render your pictures. So what I often do as part of writing code generators for a given language is I also write this transformation to visualize things. So if you process your model, you don't just get the running system, but also a bunch of GIF images or JPEGs that give you overview, some kind of overview of different aspects of your system.
Interesting. Does GraphVis, that would take, I guess what you would do is describe what shapes, which way the arrows point, and it would take care of laying that out in an aesthetic way?
Yes, more or less, but yes.
Okay, interesting.
I can't.
And of course there are, go ahead.
Well, I can't help, you know, thinking in the Visual Studio world of what's going on with Visual Studio 2010, because right now doing that kind of thing in Visual Studio just takes crazy amounts of work. But in Visual Studio 2010, it's built with WPF for presentation, and then MEF for kind of composing or pulling in different behaviors. And so I just wonder about, I can't help thinking about how that could work also inside of Visual Studio eventually.
Well, I mean, there is already stuff going on. I mean, the DSL toolkit, for example, is going to be much better integrated into the new Visual Studio. So you can easily define your own graphical DSLs and deploy them as, I don't know how you call this, Visual Studio extensions, I guess. So, I mean, it clearly moves in the same direction. And, I mean, you know how this is. Microsoft isn't necessarily very innovative in these things. They look at what the market does, and then once they decide that something is really useful, they get behind it with a lot of power, and then they, start they start a couple of, 100 feet behind everybody else, but then they run much faster than anybody else because they have more money and more manpower. So I think that's what could possibly happen with this Oslo stuff, right? What I've seen is by far not as good yet as what, for example, Eclipse can do, but the subset of functionality they have really looks promising. So if they continue, and if, the strategy guys at Microsoft think is useful and worth continuing, then there is really the possibility of creating a really nice integrated and also Visual Studio integrated environment. But you never know until it's released.
How successful do you think you've been with this approach relative to if you would have not built your own external DSL or not tried model-driven development? You know what I mean? How more productive do you think you are? Like 50%, 100%, 10%?
The problem is always that you never do anything twice, once traditionally and then with DSLs. So personally, I've been doing this for a couple of years now. I've spent almost all my time working in this space. And since I'm a coach, I don't work myself. I only help other people work. So if I wanted to judge the productivity gains, then I would have to look at what my customers do. And there I clearly see significant improvements. Now, the numbers really vary. I mean, Metacase, another vendor of domain-specific language creation tools, has this thing that the DSM, the domain-specific modeling stuff, is 10 times more productive than UML. Now, of course, they want to sell tools, so I guess they have to say that. So I really don't like to put numbers on it. But, I mean, if you think about it, what computer science is about is it is about defining the right abstractions for describing something and then finding a way to express those abstractions and efficiently implementing that in code. And that's what model-driven and DSLs is all about. So I would say that if you're a developer, then adding this skill to your toolbox, the ability of defining languages and code generators, is something that is very, very broadly applicable, right? It's much more broadly applicable than learning WPF version 2.5, which in 2 years from now is outdated, right? So it's a very powerful concept and set of tools that this gives you. And it, although you might have to specify or build languages for each use case or for each domain, the approach of building languages and generators is very broadly applicable. And I would really urge everybody to try this stuff. I always say there were two things that changed my professional career significantly. One was in, I guess it was around 2000 or 99, Design Patterns. I bought the Gang of Four book. I read it like a Bible. I read all the other books. I started writing patterns, went to the conferences, writing my own pattern books, right? So this really influenced me significantly. Because why? Because patterns are a way of capturing knowledge on a level that is a little bit more abstract than the API of the day, right? And the second thing that changed my career, I think, is this whole modeling and model-driven stuff. And again, it's probably for the same reason, because defining languages and generators is yet another way of capturing knowledge and know-how and implementation strategies in a formal way and making that broadly applicable and, giving the generator to a team and they just run it and they get the right kind of code out of the system. So I think it's very, very worthwhile. But I don't have numbers.
No, but you bring up a really, really good point. And I think we've really been feeling that over the last few years. New technologies just keep flying out from all over the place. And it's a little bit hard to keep up, but people spend so much time focusing on the technology of the day that you kind of let some other skills fall behind.
Yes, and you know, I mean, I'm getting older. I mean, I'm not really old yet, but I do get older, and I do notice that I'm not as quick anymore as I was in learning new things. And I'm also not interested in learning the newest version of some stupid API. So if I have a way of conserving certain, you know, domain know-how, business things in a formal way, and then if a new language or tool or framework comes out, I just write a new generator. That's a very good way for me of focusing on the important stuff and encapsulating the technical details. Well, these are also important, but it's a different important, right? It's a different concern, and the code generator allows you to isolate this technology concern from the domain know-how to some extent, and I think that's very useful. And again, that's just one brief thing. The thing is really, the tools have matured to a point where building languages is not something that building simple languages and a simple code generator is not something that takes weeks or months, okay? If you have some routine with these tools, you build these things within days. And so this whole argument of building languages is so complex and takes so much time, it doesn't really apply. Of course, if you build very, very complex languages or several languages that somehow interconnect and they're, you know, have complicated semantics and type systems, well, sure, then it's a lot of more work, and it's a lot, you know, really non-trivial. But building simple languages that generate, you know, certain repetitive aspects of certain stupid platforms, easy to do.
All right, excellent. Unless anyone else has any other questions on that topic, I think we're getting pretty close to an hour. So if there's anything else to cover, we might want to transition. I think John wants to ask you about Axum.
I did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you wrote a post on Axum back in May talking about how, you know, it's Erlang for .NET kind of, and I just wondered kind of what your thoughts were on it.
So do we expect that the listeners know what Axum is, or?
Maybe not. Yeah.
Possibly not.
Okay. So Axum, well, first let me preface that I haven't worked with it and I'm not an expert, but I read the documentation that's available, the tutorial, and it was it looked quite interesting. So what Axum is a language for writing concurrent code. As you know, we have this problem that computers don't get faster, but we get more and more of them. So we need to write code that actually uses the concurrency or all the various processors that are available and so on and so on. So, you know, the free lunch is over, blah, blah, blah. So we have to write code that is able to exploit the available concurrency. So, and as we probably also know, is that this whole, you know, shared memory and sharing of stuff and then using complicated locking protocols can become complex very, very quickly. And so currently there is a number of, you know, trends here. One is functional programming, think F#, for example, that, you know, because if you do pure functional programming, you have no side effects, you have no shared data, so you never need to lock. That's nice. Another approach that's maybe related is messaging. So instead of having shared data between two different program entities, what you do is you isolate them from each other and then you have them exchange messages. And one of the primary or of the most well-known implementations of that approach is Erlang. It provides a very, very scalable and fine-grained actor implementation. Actors are actually, it's a programming paradigm that, you know, is quite old, active objects, actors. And Erlang has an implementation for that. The problem with Erlang is that I think two things. One, the syntax is unnecessarily strange, right? I mean, it's very strange. And, you know, it doesn't have curly braces, so it will never be mainstream. The other thing is that it has its own runtime system, which is, of course, optimized for this fine-grained concurrency, but it's also not a standard runtime environment, which makes it, you know, hard to convince people to use. So what Microsoft did is, it's not a product, it's a research project currently, is come up with a language called Axum, which is a data flow oriented language. And of course it runs on the CLR, which solves the runtime platform being different problem. So what you can do with Axum is you basically write your programs along the pipes and filters pattern. So you have pieces of functionality, filters, they're basically functions in Axum that get some data as input and through what they call a channel, and then transform the data in some way, process the data in some way, and output the result into another channel. And so far, so good. What Axum now comes with is built-in operators for composing such filters with each other. So you can describe non-trivial chains, like, you know, here we have an input that reads the data from a file, let's say, and then it, you know, it puts this data into a multiplexer where the data is put into 10 channels that are then, of course, concurrently running on 10 different cores. Well, not the channels, but the functions that process the data in the channels, they run concurrently. So, and then, you know, the data is pushed to these 10 functions. They process the data, they put it into another channel, which then, you know, puts it into another function that does another step of processing. And at some point, they are collected together again. The values from the 10 different channels are put together into one. And then, you know, the overall sum is computed or whatever. So, and what this language comes with is language primitives for defining such chains of data flow pipelines. And I've never seen that in a language before. Of course, you can build all kinds of frameworks that do it, but as you probably suspect, I think it's a good idea to have these things as language primitives, because then the compiler and the type system can be, you know, is able to give you meaningful error messages. So that's basically what XM is, in my view. Other people might emphasize things differently. And I think it's interesting to see that different paradigms are tried out to solve this concurrency stuff, right? We have the traditional shared memory, and even in that space, there is a lot of stuff going on in transactional memory, where you don't have to explicitly acquire, release, and lock locks, right? But you just say, you know, the following code should execute as if it were not concurrent. And so basically what they is called basically like a transaction, it's isolated and so on, ACID properties. And so that's one area of research. The other one is this message passing as implemented in Erlang or Scala. And then there is this data flow approach, which is now shown or exemplified from through XM. And I think the jury is out. I don't know which of these approaches will be the solution for the new concurrency, maybe all of them, but it's just cool to see the activity in that space.
I think you had one other topic on your list, which was product line engineering.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not. I mean, I don't know. If you want, I don't know.
I haven't even heard that term. So, I mean, if you want to at least define it or introduce us, I think that would be helpful.
Okay, so product line engineering is basically about not building single software systems, but rather building families or product lines. So imagine you're a manufacturer of mobile phones, or the software for mobile phones like Nokia. Then basically every phone basically looks the same, right? They have a display, it has a bunch of buttons, at least the 10 number buttons plus, you know, the green and the red one. So all the different software systems for these various phones are kind of similar, but not identical. So it is a good idea, instead of writing each of these systems from scratch or through copy and paste reuse, it's a good idea to analyze the commonalities and the differences between those different phones. You put the commonalities into what's usually called a platform, and then you have a systematic way of defining the differences and the various features for the various phones. And product line engineering is about defining a disciplined and systematic and structured way of handling these differences and the commonalities, of course. So a term that's used here then is often, you know, variant management, managing the variability between the various members of the product line. And then what you need to do is you need to come up with ways of expressing these variants in your code, you know, and there are various ways. One thing is, if you do C programming, you can use ifdefs, right? Ifdef the one phone, put the following code in, else if the other phone, you put the other code in. And there are various other ways of doing that. Of course, I think that expressing some of this variability through domain-specific languages is a very good idea. So that's the connection between model-driven and product lines. But product line engineering in general is, some people call it systematic reuse, right? So you don't write something and afterwards you think about, yeah, you know, which piece could I reuse? But rather you define a family of related systems with systematic reuse in mind from the beginning. And if you do that right, you can really reap significant savings from that. I mean, significant. Of course, it requires a quite disciplined approach. It might require changes in the organization and the funding of projects, because you do a lot of cross-project work. So there is this whole organizational and process dimension to it. But it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, a lot of people will say that trying to go out and build a, to, and building, let me back that up. A lot of people will say if you try to go out and build a platform or a framework without actually having some sort of end goal in mind, you know, without extracting it from an existing application or an existing product, that you always end up with a lot of stuff that you don't need, and it's very difficult.
Sure. I mean, certainly you need a lot of experience in a given domain to determine whether a product line approach makes sense, and then also to understand what are the commonalities and the differences. And usually you should have built a number of products in that domain before you think about doing product lines. So that's clear. But once you realize that you always build the same kind of system, it's probably a good idea to try to optimize that process and build tools for you to express the variability very efficiently. And there is a formalism that's often used called feature models, which is a very high level way of just defining, you know, features, stuff that's in the product and stuff that's not in the product. You can then use all kinds of techniques to map the variability, the high-level variability in the feature models down to implementation artifacts and how these change based on the features that are in the product or not. But I agree. I mean, you should only do that if you know what you're doing.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, many consulting houses or product vendors build similar products. I don't know of many product vendors that build cars today and airplanes tomorrow and train engines, the third day. And if you, for example, I live in Stuttgart, there is a lot of automotive industry and a lot of vendors in that space. You know, the large electronics vendors, who build the ECUs, the electronic control units that go into the cars. I mean, a window wiper is basically the same independent of the car you put it in. It might, you know, use a different bus for communication, or it might have a slightly different algorithm because Daimler has a somewhat more fancy window wiper than Hyundai or whatever. But basically, it's the same. And if you don't exploit these similarities, you will spend a lot more money in redeveloping everything from scratch. So I think in this environment where you build similar but not identical products, this whole product line thing has very big potential.
So Marcus, is there anything exciting coming up for you? Are there any conferences in the future, anywhere you're going to speak or anything you're publishing?
Well, I hope the weather is going to be better so I can have some exciting flies with my glider. But other than that, so the conference is coming up. I'll be at SPLC, which is the Software Product Lines Conference in San Francisco, end of August. And I'll be at the Models Conference in October in Denver. So I have tutorials at both of these conferences. Otherwise, what else is coming up? I'm not going to be at Uppsala this year. So I guess that's all. That's all that's, at least on your side of the Atlantic. There are a couple of smaller conferences in Germany.
Okay. How long have you been into gliders?
21 years. I started when I was 14, and I'm trying to spend as much time in the air as possible.
You're serious about it then?
Yes. I usually try to fly between 150 and 200 hours per year, which is quite a bit. It's not going to work out this year because I have to work too much. Next year.
Awesome. Is that a wrap?
Sounds like one.
Okay.
Sounds good to me.
Let me just do an outro thingy here.
Yes. Okay.
Thanks, Marcus, for being on.
Thank you for having me.
And tune in again for the next episode of Herding Code.